March 7th, 2014, in Ljubljana, Slovenia, and we're looking at organization, culture, and structure. So, okay, we've purposely made that S bigger. Because I think we've done a pretty good job in the world of having international Krishna consciousness. But what we're still trying to establish is an international society for Krishna consciousness. So today we're going to look at organizational culture. Now this is primarily a sociological presentation. This is primarily based on understanding the sociology of religion and an understanding the way that various organizations, whether it's a religious organization or whether it's a business organization, how they have their own culture. So what do we mean by organizational culture? You could describe organizational culture. Are you all following me at my rate of English, or do I need to slow down? Do I need to go slower?
So far, so good.
Anybody? Are you lost? Are you lost? Yes. Just say yes. You can just say yes. That's fine. I will slow down. So you can think of the culture of an organization as what keeps the organization together, what gives the organization its own identity. So these are some examples. Your organizational culture are the values and assumptions and expectations and definitions that we are not even consciously aware of. That's why we call them taken for granted. They're taken for granted. We're not... Which way? If I move this way, then my head gets turned and my neck will hurt by the end of the presentation. If you have another table, do you have another table? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, yeah, if I sit over there, then I'm always turning here, and then when I finish, I have a pain here. So. Is that okay now?
So far, so good.
Okay.
Because we move there, you also move there.
Yeah, okay. We'll see. I have to be straight. So... these are some examples, and these are examples of opposites. So do we assume that people are basically good and responsible, or do we assume that people need constant supervision? Those are two opposite assumptions from two different cultures. Do we say that a member is somebody who lives in a temple and works tightly under authority? A member is anyone who says they're a member. These are just examples, and these I'm trying to give opposite examples. And again, this is part of what makes a culture. Organizational culture is also how do we do things? And again, these are not things that we say. This is not in our conscious awareness. These are things that we assume. Do you all understand what I mean by things that we assume? No. Okay, so each of us has a certain set of ideas and beliefs about the way the world is. How does the world work? How do things work? And those ideas, those beliefs, we just so much know that they're true that we're not aware that they might not be true. It's things that have become obvious to us that are probably not actually true, but we just think, oh, that's true. We don't even think about it. We don't even think about it. We don't even have an awareness that we think this way. So every society of humans on Earth has a culture, and by culture we don't mean do people wear saris or do they wear pants? That's not what we mean by culture. What we mean by culture is how do you do things? What is the meaning that you give to things? What does something mean? So an example that I give a lot is if you go to India and you're eating, people will just put prasadam on your plate. They won't ask you, do you want this? They'll just give it to you. And if you say, no, I don't want it, they'll give it to you anyway. Now, in America, we don't do that. In America, we say to somebody, would you like this? And if they say no, we don't give it to them. So we ask, and then if they say no, we believe them. And in America, that means that you respect somebody. So in America, if I just put food on someone's plate without asking them, or if they said no and I still put it on their plate, that would be extremely disrespectful and rude. But it's not that people in India are being disrespectful and rude. They're not. They simply have different cultural assumptions. So in America, the cultural assumption is that if you want something, you'll ask for it, that people are going to be honest about what they want, and that it's very important to give people just what they want. That's a cultural assumption. In India, the cultural assumption is that people will not ask for what they want, that you have to guess what they want, that it's your job to guess what somebody else wants, and it's your job to give them what they want without them asking for it, and that we're not supposed to ask for things. Other people need to guess what we want, and if they guess wrong, we just don't get it. And that the way you show respect for people is by guessing what they want and giving them what you guess they want so they don't have to ask. So in India, if you have to ask for what you want, that's very embarrassing. So both cultures are interested in respect. But how they understand respect is very, very, very different. It's very different. So in India, if you have to ask for what you want, the person who's serving you feels that they've made a mistake, that they didn't understand you properly, and you have to ask. In America, to ask for what you want is just normal. You're supposed to ask for what you want. In America, you're not supposed to guess what people want. You ask them. In India, you're not supposed to ask them because they won't tell you. You're just supposed to guess. So I'm giving this example because most of us are familiar with Indian culture, but the same is true for various cultures in the world. So this is what we mean by a culture. Now, these are some ideas. Do we sacrifice a project for people, or do we sacrifice people for a project? Now again, we won't say that. We're not going to get up and say, we sacrifice a project for people, or we sacrifice a people for a project. Even if we do say it, it doesn't mean anything. But we have ideas about what's right, and those ideas create our culture. So if we have an idea that people are supposed to be sacrificed for a project, then I will sacrifice myself for a project, and I will expect other people to sacrifice themselves for a project. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, I might not say that, but that's what I'll be thinking that's the right thing to do. Another example here is, how do we decide things? Do we decide things in a very formal way, that leaders get together, have a meeting, make a decision, and then tell everybody, you do this, you do this, you do this? Or do we decide things in a more loose, informal structure, that different groups get together at different times and decide things? And it's not that one of those ways is right and one of those ways is wrong. They're simply different. And each organization has a different culture. Is this clear so far? Okay, here are some other examples. The culture of an organization it affects how we think, how we feel, and how we behave with each other. For example, in some organizations, you can talk about anything, even if it's very uncomfortable. In other organizations, you can only talk about things if they're already okay. And then in some organizations, whatever you do, you first have to ask permission. In other organizations, you can do things and you can get permission later. In some organizations, the leaders are considered responsible for all the problems. In other organizations, everyone is considered to be responsible to make it a good organization. Now again, these are different cultural ideas. We're talking about organizational culture now, not like Indian or American or Slovenian culture. These are different concepts that we're generally not aware that we even have. These are different things that we believe to be true. Are you all with me here? So culture, our organizational culture tends to be something very deep and very unconscious that we believe to be true without realizing that it's a belief. We just think it's true. We just think this is the way it is. This is what's truth. And part of why we want to study organizational culture is to understand that these are not things that are true. They are simply things that we believe to be true. Now, of course, if you have an organization where there's many different cultures in the organization, you end up having a problem. And we struggle with that to some extent because we are a very international society and our members are bringing in cultural beliefs from their materialistic culture, from their national culture, from their ethnic culture. They're bringing that into the Hare Krishna movement. And a lot of the culture we create within our temples and our society is really coming. You see that. You go to different parts of the world and you see the culture of ISKCON is affected by the outside culture. So what does organizational culture do? Well, first of all, it gives an identity that separates you from others. Now, what is ISKCON and where's the boundary between ISKCON and not ISKCON is defined to some extent by our organizational culture. And it gives us a sense of identity, you know, that I know what the rules are. Organizational culture tells us what the rules are. How are we supposed to behave? What is expected of us? What do we expect of others? Also, it facilitates our commitment to the organization because we know what it means to commit to the organization. We know what's expected of us. It makes our social system somewhat stable and it allows us to make sense of what's happening in the organization, how we explain things. As I was giving the example between the way people serve food in America and how they serve food in India, that allows you to make sense out of it. You decide, oh, this is a rude person or this is a respectful person in relationship to the culture. So having a culture allows you to make sense of things and to understand things. So sociologists also describe organizational culture as a way to interpret symbols and events and a way to solve problems. For example, so one of our GBC members, Badri Narayan Puru, just took sannyas. So sannyas involves some symbols. I was looking at the photographs. There's all sorts of symbols involved with him taking sannyas. There's a pile of clothes. There's a pile of saffron clothes, saffron underwear. And these clothes are taken. They're offered to Srila Prabhupada. They're offered to the Panchatattva. They're offered to Radha Madhava. They're touched by the different sannyasis. And then he goes and puts them on. Those are all very symbolic things to do. Then he gets his danda. Again, these are all symbols. So what do these symbols mean? You know, I was thinking, looking at these photographs, that in the Hare Krishna movement, sannyas is our position of the highest status, or one of the highest statuses you can get, is by being a sannyasi. And that's very interesting, because in modern society, the highest status is usually given to people who have a lot of money and a lot of fame, right? A lot of power. Of the six opulences in modern secular society, we do not give the highest status to people who have a lot of renunciation. We give the highest status to people who have a lot of beauty, wealth, strength, fame, and knowledge, much more than renunciation. So the fact that we give, that when somebody takes the symbols of sannyas, that the meaning that we give to that is this is a high status person in society, affects our organizational culture and is a result of our organizational culture. Are you all understanding the point? Okay? We have a culture in ISKCON that says renunciation is the highest opulence. Renunciation is the most important of the six opulences. And then we ascribe meaning to symbols of renunciation. Also events. How do we interpret events when things happen in our movement? What's the meaning that we give to them? And prioritizing values within a context of meaning. Saying what's more important. Which values are the most important? What's our overall meaning? Also what we expect. What do we consider ideal? What would we consider an ideal temple? What would we consider an ideal devotee? What do we consider ideal devotee relationships? All of these are coming from our concepts of culture. Is this clear to everybody? Right? So if we have a culture that you have to ask permission first, and if someone does something without permission, then we give a meaning to that. We say, oh, this person is a rebel. This person isn't a good member of the society. But the meaning we give to that comes from our culture. So if we have a culture that people are just supposed to take initiatives and they can ask blessings later, then the person who waits to ask permission, we give that a meaning of, oh, this is a cowardly person. Is this clear to everybody? It's the same action. So a person goes and does something. Somebody goes and starts their own preaching center. They just go and start a preaching center. Do we see that as, oh, they are a very loyal servant of Prabhupada, or we see they're a rebel? That depends on our culture. If we have the culture that you have to get permission first, then they're a rebel. If we have the culture that you can get permission later, then they can be a very good servant of the mission. Now, when our culture fits our mission, then things go very smoothly. So it's entirely possible to have a culture that doesn't fit your mission and your ideals. It's completely possible to have a mismatch between culture and mission. And I see that this is especially a challenge for us. Sorry. This is especially a challenge for us in our international society. The fact that we're an international society makes this a huge challenge, because all of us are bringing in cultural ideas and cultural beliefs from the outside. Also, the fact that the majority of our members in most places were not born and raised in the Hare Krishna movement is also very challenging, because we're coming and we're saying, all right, we want to understand Vedic culture, although we don't really know what Vedic culture is. You know, and we want to have an ISKCON culture. Again, we're not really sure what that is. But we're bringing in things from our childhood cultures that we're not aware of. We're not even aware that we're bringing it in. You know, we just, again, culture, the way culture works is you just think, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's what's true. And you don't even know that it's there to question it. Oh, that's going to block people's view again. Why don't you just put it on? Thank you. Thank you so much. And hopefully I won't knock it over. And culture, so when the culture and the mission fits, then you really have people know how to solve problems, they prioritize their values appropriately, their identity as membership is very clear. All right, now these sort of things are what people often think about when they think of culture. Do we eat on the floor or at a table? Do we eat with spoons or with our fingers? You know, do we play cartels or a guitar? What do we call each other? How do the men and women behave? We usually think of this sort of thing, but this is not what we mean by organizational culture. These things may be some symptoms of the culture, but they're not in and of themselves the culture. The culture is what we believe to be true about values and human interaction without realizing that it's a belief. With just thinking, yes, that's true. That's the way it's supposed to be done. You can think of organizational culture as a paradigm, a lens through which we interpret and understand everything. Now, I say this quite often because I think it's very important and very misunderstood that when we come to the Hare Krishna movement, one of the first things we are taught is that we have imperfect senses, a cheating propensity, that we're illusioned, and that we make mistakes. But what I've seen is that it's very hard to say, okay, I have those four defects, and that means what I think is right and true may not be. What I think is right and true may just be my conditioning. You could talk about culture as a certain kind of conditioning. You're conditioned that this is the way you show respect, this is the way things are supposed to be done, this is what this means, and this is what this means. It's really a kind of conditioning. But we're so conditioned by our conditioning that we don't realize it's conditioning. We just think that's, of course, it's obvious. It has to be done like that. Now, there's more than one way to have an organization. And if there's anything that you get from this presentation, I hope that you would get this. One of the assumptions or beliefs that I run into among ISKCON members and leaders a lot is the idea that because ISKCON is an organization, that anything that's an organization must have a one particular kind of culture and one particular kind of structure. But there's many, 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 many different cultures you can have in an organization. And there's many different structures you can have in an organization. We can choose which culture and which structure we would like to have in ISKCON that would fit our mission. We don't have to have a particular culture or a particular structure simply because we are an organization. And I find this particular belief is quite strong in ISKCON. Organization means, has to be, as soon as you say organized, it has to be organized in a particular way. That is simply not the case. There are many, many, many different ways for human beings to work together to accomplish the same aims. I was just seeing a video, I didn't watch the whole thing, by this one business consultant. And she looked at three different companies in different parts of the world. The companies were all producing similar products, but they had completely different ways of organizing and completely different organizational cultures. Completely. But in each place, they thought, the way we're doing it, that's the only way. That's the right way. But all three were achieving the same result with very different structures and very different cultures. So there are many, 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 many models of organizational culture. This is one model. This is not the only model. I wouldn't even say it's necessarily the best model. If you do some research on organizational culture, you will find many, many different kinds of models. So why did I pick this model? I picked this model because, first of all, it's extremely easy to understand. Second of all, it's extremely easy to apply. Third of all, it really fits with Varnashram. And a lot of the other models that I've seen, you know, I'd really have to struggle to how does it really fit with Shastra and with Varnashram. So therefore, I find this model useful. I am not presenting this model as the only model, or even necessarily as the best model. And I find it the best model for my purposes of teaching organizational culture to devotees. However, if you decide you really want to research organizational culture, you may end up finding that there's another model that you personally feel is better and more suitable. So this model is looking at two different parameters: whether the organization is internally focused or externally focused. Are you focused mostly on your own members, or are you focused mostly outside of your own members? And is the organization more stable or more flexible? I remember when I was in India, a couple years ago with one of my grandchildren, Janu. I brought him here. Some of you might remember I brought Janu here. So when we were in India, you know those, if any of you have been in India, you know they have these trucks. You know, here we have tractor trailer. You have a big truck, what we in America call a semi. It has like a cab in the front, and then it has the big thing in the back, and there's a connection. And they don't have trucks like that in India. I've never seen any anyway. They just, it's one piece, and it's smaller, and then they load it all the way. They load it way beyond its capacity. You know, and they have all kinds of tricks to try to load. They load everything beyond its capacity. You know, it's just kind of their thing. So, you know, if the capacity is 2 liters, then you put 3 liters into it. That's just kind of how they think. So we're seeing these trucks going down the road, and I was talking to my grandson about stability and flexibility. That if something is very stable, it's usually not very flexible. And if something is very flexible, it's usually not very stable. So he looked at those trucks and he said, "Grandma, these are not flexible or stable." Now, we are looking, of course, for something that's totally flexible and totally stable. I see we only find that spiritually. Krishna is completely stable and completely flexible at the same time. He's unlimitedly stable and unlimitedly flexible. But in the material world, it's usually a trade-off. If I get flexibility, I lose some stability. If I get some stability, I lose some flexibility. Flexibility and stability is very much related to the ashrams. The grihastha ashram is very stable. The vanaprastha and sannyas ashram, you lose that stability, but you gain flexibility. Yes?
Is it possible to somehow balance stability and flexibility within the organization?
To some extent, but the problem is that if you're fully balanced, you tend to get the results of neither. This is also true if you study personality types. So in personality types, there are some people that are not clearly any personality type. They have some of all the types. Those people generally do not have very satisfactory lives because they're just sort of nothing. You know, if you try to be just balanced everything, you end up being not much of anything. Is what happens. I mean, Krishna has these personality types that are in opposition to one another, and he has them all perfectly. But I don't see that exactly that Krishna is balanced in all the personality types. I know it doesn't seem to be like that. It seems to be that they're all there, and he exhibits them in different circumstances. But Krishna is not like simultaneously balancing the Dhiradhata with the Dhiraprasanta. I don't know of any pastime where those two things are what I would call in perfect balance. Although they're both there. Some are exhibited more than others. But the closest I think you're going to get to balance is something where you can move along the continuum as needed. But generally, an individual or an organization is not able to fully move along this whole continuum as needed anytime. Krishna can do that. Krishna can move anywhere along the continuum as needed. But we as jivas don't seem to be able to do that. We seem to have some area where we're stronger and some area where we're weaker. And the same with organizations. You know, if you try to be everything to everyone, you end up being nothing to anyone. It just really doesn't work. Then you don't really have an identity. Does that make some sense? You don't really have a personality. You don't really have an identity. Now, we can have an ISKCON, and what we are already starting to have an ISKCON more and more, is many subcultures. So we are starting to have an ISKCON where there's certain places that have a particular culture that's quite different from other places. That is definitely happening. We do have to some extent, a worldwide ISKCON culture. But to another extent, it can be quite different in different places. And it can be quite radically different in different places. I mean, for example, you know, what is it considered respectful to talk about? So I found, for example, in Radhadesh, where we have a college, and we have a lot of devotees who are in academia come there. We have a lot of scholars, and we have a lot of scholars who work in secular, you know, in non-devotional universities, come there and give classes. So the mood in Radha Desh is very open. You know, in Bhagavatam class, anybody can ask a question about anything. Really, anybody can bring up any doubt or any question in a public class. But in most temples I go to, you couldn't do that. Some of the questions that are brought up there, if you brought them up, people would really look at you. And you'd get some social stigma for doing that. You'd get ostracized, yes. So I haven't seen the atmosphere that's in Radha Desh, I haven't seen in too many other places. There's a different, because there's a college there, and because there's a lot of youth there. So there's a lot of second generation devotees, you know, devotees who've been born in the movement are there, and the college are there. The culture there is definitely somewhat different, because there's no other place in the world that has that situation. None. It's the only temple that has that kind of a situation. And, you know, if you go to Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, which has a very high percentage of Indians, the culture is a little different than at ISKCON Soho, which is only a half an hour drive away, that doesn't have as many Indians in the congregation. So you will find these differences within the organization in certain places, or also within certain groups. You know, like I work with the Back to Godhead staff, we have our own organizational culture among ourselves. It's a very small group, and everything we discuss is confidential. And we have to review articles to see whether or not they can be published in our international magazine. We have a pretty intense organizational culture among ourselves. We're supposed to be criticizing the articles. That's our job. That's our service. And frankly, we're also supposed to sometimes be criticizing the authors. So, you know, we will say things in that group that are not normally said in other places in ISKCON. You know, we'll say, who is this author? What's their position in ISKCON? What do they do?
So you don't tell to the author? No,
among ourselves.
How about the author?
Correct. That's correct. We have to. That's our job. That's our service. If we don't do that, sometimes we're embarrassed by publishing something, and then someone says, why did you publish this? Don't you know who this person is? You know, and we have to look at things and say, well, that's a bunch of bogus philosophy. Again, we don't generally do that in ISKCON. I don't generally go up to somebody and say, Prabhu, you know, that's a bunch of bogus philosophy. But in our editorial staff, that's exactly what we do. That's our service. We have to do that. So that's a group within ISKCON that has a very different organizational culture than ISKCON in general. You know, and we don't use formalities much with each other at all. When we get new members, it takes a while for them to become involved in our culture. And we also don't think much about seniors and juniors. You know, we want the juniors to be able to say what they see as the truth, even if they're critiquing the article of a senior. They have to. Again, if they're not doing that, then they're not doing their service. But the sort of behavior that we have to do in that group would be very improper in most other places in our movement. So my point is, there's also small projects or groups or sometimes big projects in ISKCON that have a different culture. So there may be, you know, a temple may have a very stable culture, but there may be a project within that temple that has a very flexible culture. So that's how I see, if we're going to talk about balance, that we achieve balance more like that. Do you really want to open the window? You can open it for a little while until I start freezing again. Sorry, one problem with talking very slowly is that people get sleepy listening to me. Yes, it's a problem. If I talk fast, then you won't understand me, and if I talk slowly, I will put you all to sleep. So, you know, when we're talking about organizational culture, we do need to think, am I talking about all of ISKCON? There is a certain culture that's almost everywhere in ISKCON. And then there are certain cultures that are in one temple but not in another, or in one project but not in another, in one group of people but not in another. you know, when this was taught to the GBC, the exercise that hopefully we'll get to do today, that was done just looking at the GBC culture. It wasn't looking at ISKCON culture as a whole, but what was the culture of the GBC body. Okay, so organizational culture is usually somewhere in this flexible, stable line and somewhere in this internal-external line. Now, you know, people and organizations don't really fit into little boxes. So keep this as a general guideline and know that we're not going to fit neatly into a box. But here you have, over here, this is a culture that's very flexible and internal. Here's a culture that's very stable and internal. Here's a culture that's very flexible and external. And here's a culture that's very stable and external. Again, external and internal means where's your focus? Again, you can see differences like some ISKCON centers, they're very focused on preaching to the public. Some ISKCON centers, they're much more focused on their own members. You know, we all have some stability and some flexibility and some external focus and some internal focus. This is where is your primary culture? All right, so what are the differences between these? Well, what are they governed by? What are they governed by? So the family culture is governed by what we call norms and principles. So most families don't have a big rule book, right? Maybe some families, but most families, there's a few rules. But mostly it's principles. Okay, you have to, you know, everybody has to help out. Everybody has to be respectful. You have to clean up after yourselves. Those are principles. They're not exactly rules. And there may be some rules, like, okay, the teenagers have to be home at 10 o'clock at night or something like that. But generally, they're governed by norms and principles. A hierarchical culture is governed by formal rules. A hierarchical culture has a big rule book. Rule number 1.2.3.7.9. And then, you know, something else happens and it's 1.7.3.7.9a. Okay? A market culture is governed by responsibility and integrity, by meeting commitments, by agreements. So we make agreements and we keep them. That's a market culture. An adhocracy culture is governed by mutual adjustments. So I work with you, you work with me, and we say, I don't think you should do it that way. Oh, okay, I won't do it that way. Or why don't we do it this way? Okay, let's do it this way. So you can see the adhocracy culture is extremely flexible. Do you see how these two are more flexible? Principles are very flexible. How do you apply principles? And mutual adjustments are also very flexible. Whereas meeting commitments is much more stable. It's much more inflexible. We have an agreement, we have a contract, and that's what we do. Or these are our rules, that's what we do. Okay, what's the focus of each one? The focus of family culture is people. Taking care of people, relationships between people. The focus of an adhocracy culture is ideas and knowledge. Adhocracy cultures are used in businesses that are innovating, that are creating. When America first started the NASA program, I don't know if it's true anymore, but at first the NASA program was run very much as an adhocracy culture. Market culture is very concerned with resources. And a hierarchical culture is very concerned with processes and skills. Okay, what's sort of the mood? The mood of a family culture is cooperation. But in a family, some people are higher and some people are lower. Right? You have the grandfather, you have the father, you have the children. So it's cooperation, but it's not cooperation between equals. It's cooperation between some people who are equal, some people who are higher, and some people who are lower. In an adhocracy culture, it's collaboration. Collaboration is you're working together. It's more an equal culture. There's not so much a sense of higher and lower in an adhocracy culture. In a market culture, the basic formula is competition. You're competing with one another to see who's the best. And in a hierarchical culture, it's control. You can see both the hierarchical culture and the family culture are very much, again, they're internal focused, so they're very much on who's higher and who's lower within the organization. There's really a sense of status. But in a hierarchical culture, the people who are higher are controlling the people who are lower, and in a family culture, they're cooperating. Whereas with the external focus, there's not so much of a sense of status in the organization, who's higher and who's lower, because that's more fluid. So in a market culture, who's higher and who's lower changes according to competition. So if I win today, I'm higher, and if you win tomorrow, you're higher. And in an adhocracy culture, there's much more of a sense of working with peers. And again, who takes higher and lower positions is according to what you're doing with knowledge. All right, we can say that Prabhupada have a particular desire. And Prabhupada talked a lot about family and being based on love and trust. So we could say if Prabhupada favored one of these cultures, he seems to have favored mostly the family culture. Now again, when we're doing this exercise today, we have a choice about thinking of the whole of ISKCON, or we can think of a culture for just the Brahmins in ISKCON, just the GBC, just the Back to Godhead editors, or just the Ljubljana temple. You know, you can really look at different areas. My suggestion is that when we do this exercise today, we look at the Ljubljana temple and not try to do this for ISKCON as a whole. Because ISKCON as a whole, although there is a thread of culture throughout ISKCON as a whole, it's quite different in different places. All right, we're going to look at Varna and organizational culture. So we have the four Varnas. Now, Varna means how you interact with the world to earn a livelihood, basically. That's basically what Varna means, how you get your income. By the way, Varna is really only practiced in the Grahastha ashram. There is no practicing of Varna in the Vanaprastha and Sannyas ashram. And in the Brahmacharya ashram, there's preparation for Varna. But Varna duties are only exhibited in the Grahastha ashram. Just like you think of the Kshatriya kings, right? When they take Vanaprastha, they stop being Kshatriya kings. They stop ruling. In fact, interestingly, when Ram was exiled to the forest, you may know this story, right, the sages went to Ram for protection and said, you know, the Rakshasas are eating us, please protect us. And Ram said, I will protect you. And then afterwards, Sita said, what are you doing? Why are you telling the sages you'll protect them? You're in the forest. You know, you're living like a vanaprastha in the forest. You have no business doing the business of a king. And Ram said, well, it's not really that I've retired. I'm just temporarily in exile. He said it, and I'm assisting Bharat, who's on the throne. He said, anyway, I've already promised. But there was that discussion that a Kshatriya living in the forest wouldn't be doing Kshatriya duties. So these Varnas apply just to the Grahastha ashram. And this is how one interacts with the world and how one makes a livelihood. So the Brahmanas, they make their livelihood by teaching, by being teachers, by being priests, by being intellectuals and science. The Kshatriyas make their livelihood by running governments, or Prabhupada also said by being landlords, basically by collecting money from people and then using that money to care for the people. Then the Vaishyas are the only ones who actually generate wealth. The Vaishyas make their livelihood by turning natural resources and animals into wealth, and the Shudras make their livelihood from the arts, the crafts, the skills, and the services. So what do they protect? The Brahmanas are supposed to protect knowledge. They're supposed to keep knowledge pure. The Kshatriyas are supposed to protect people. The Vaishyas are supposed to protect the natural resources and the animals. And the Sudras are supposed to protect the arts, the crafts, and the skills. So this is, and this particular graphic here is one of the two main differences between a Vedic Varnashram and any other society. Because in every society, there are intellectuals, and there's government, and there's business persons and farmers, and there's craftspersons and service people, right? Every society has that. I mean, you'd have to be a really primitive society not to have that. some really, really primitive tribal society, not to have those kind of divisions. But in a materialistic society, everyone is exploiting their area. So in a materialistic society, people see their area as, oh, this is my area to enjoy, this is my area to exploit. And the idea of Varnashram is this is your area to protect. So that's one of the two main differences between Varnashram and any other society. And the other difference is protect it as God's property, not just protect it. That I have a function within the universal body of God, and that function is to protect. So what do they produce? The Brahmanas produce wisdom and guidance for society. The Kshatriyas produce peace, order, and care. The Vaishyas produce honest natural wealth, and the Sudras produce services, entertainment, and objects. The Sudras are producing, you know, chairs, right? Dancing, music, etc. What is their interest? So the Brahmanas are interested in truth and liberation, in moksha. The Kshatriyas are interested in dharma, morality, ethics, justice, fairness. The Vaishyas are interested in artha, in wealth, in prosperity. And the Shudras are interested in kama, in pleasure. So the Vedic Shudras, of course, are interested in pious pleasures, in uplifting pleasures. And what are they controlled by? And we're going back to organizational culture. So the Brahmanas are very much controlled by mutual adjustment. That the Brahmanas adjust each other and work with each other in a very collegial way. The Kshatriyas are very much controlled by ethics and norms. Righteousness. It's very much the mode of passion. The Vaishyas, of course, are controlled by competition among each other, and the Shudras are controlled by the rule of law. Now, of course, there's competition everywhere. The Kshatriyas compete with each other over who's going to win the war. The Brahmanas compete with each other in debate. The Sudras compete with each other about who's the best athlete and who's the best artist. Competition is there in all of the Varnas. Competition helps keep the Varnas pure, helps keep the Varnas at a very high standard. Prabhupada said competition gives life. There's rules and laws everywhere. I mean, the Brahmanas also have to follow the laws of God. You can't, no one's above the laws. There's some mutual adjustment again everywhere. And there should be ethics and norms everywhere. So this is talking about the primary way that those Varnas function. So we can understand then which organizational culture is suited for the different Varnas. And we find that in Prabhupada's descriptions, I was just listening this morning, where Prabhupada was saying how that these different Varnas would have their own communities. So there wasn't envy between them, and there wasn't competition between them. So two Brahmanas would compete with each other in debate, but a Brahmana would not compete with a Kshatriya. And two Kshatriyas would compete on the battlefield, but a Kshatriya wouldn't compete with a Shudra. And two Shudras would compete who can make the best pottery and who can do the best singing, but they wouldn't be competing with the Brahmanas. So each had, in many ways, their own culture. All right, how do we understand what is an organization's culture? If we want to figure out, okay, what kind of culture do we have? Now remember, this is difficult to do because our culture is based on things that we believe to be true without understanding that those are beliefs. Culture is basically what I believe to be true and not realizing that it's my belief. I just think it's true. So how do I find my culture? I don't see it. It's invisible. So the way to find the culture, the way to find the paradigm, is by looking at the external manifestations of the culture. So these are the six things that we look at. What stories do people tell about the organization? Who are the heroes? Who are the bad guys? Who wins? How do they win? What are the symbols, like I was just talking about Badrinarayan Maharaj taking sannyas? There were a lot of symbols in that ceremony. So what are the symbols of the organization? What are the rituals and the routines? Now here again, I'm not talking about rituals and routines that come from the Shastra as part of bhakti. I'm talking about organizational rituals and organizational routines. What are the systems for control? How are people controlled? What is the structure of the organization? We'll spend quite a bit of time on that. And what are the structures of power? Okay, so we're going to analyze these. I'm just going to go through these briefly, and then we're going to do a little exercise. So we're going to break up into six different groups, and we're going to be answering these kind of questions about our organization here. So what stories do people tell? What are the kind of stories that they tell? What kind of reputation does the organization have? What do these stories say about what we believe in? By stories, I mean, do you tell, okay, well, this devotee went out on Sankirtan and distributed 500 books in 2 hours, and, you know, he didn't eat or drink for 5 days beforehand, and, you know, are those the kind of stories that we tell? Or, you know, well, this person, they cheated this devotee, and they did this. What are these kind of stories that we tell? What do we talk about when we think of the history of the organization? We say, okay, what's our history? What do people start talking about? When new people come, what stories do we tell them? So what stories do we tell among ourselves? What stories do we tell new people? And who are the heroes, villains? Mavericks means the people on the edge. The people who are there. They're in the organization, but they're a little different. So the Mavericks tells you what's the norm. You follow? They may not be dissidents, they may just be, okay, so you all know Mahavishnu Swami from London? He's a real maverick, okay? He's a maverick in the Hare Krishna movement. The way he behaves, the way he dresses, is not the norm, is it? No. He intentionally wears 2 different color shoes. So that is not the normal culture in Islam. We wouldn't expect to see the devotees in general dressing the way he dresses. And figuring out that he's a maverick helps us to understand what is the norm by comparison. Do you follow? Is that clear? Yes? Bhaktivedanta Swami was in many ways a maverick also. His preaching techniques, his style of dress, he did a lot of things that were really on the edge. So he was still in the organization, but he wasn't following all of the regular culture of the organization. He was a maverick. Then the heroes and the villains, who were the bad guys? What makes somebody a bad guy? What do you have to do to become a bad guy? And what do you have to do to be a hero? Doesn't that tell you a lot about what the culture of the organization is? Yes. All right, that's stories. Then rituals and routines. So what do visitors expect when they come? What do members expect when they come? You know, if you're a member and you come to the temple, what kind of rituals and routines do you expect to happen? What sort of rituals and routines do we have in place for visitors? If we change some of them, what would you go, whoa, what happened here? You know, what are the things that are really ingrained? And what behaviors do these rituals encourage? What way of interacting with each other? Okay, when we have a new problem, how do we solve it? What are our rules? What do we do? Do we have a meeting? Do we call a meeting of the leaders? Do we just sit around talking about it? Do we write papers on it? What do we do? And again, what beliefs do these rituals represent? Okay, symboled. Do we use specific jargon or language? Definitely. The answer to that is definitely a yes. And how well known and usable by all is this? You know, how long does it take a new person to figure out our jargon and language? It took a couple years. It took me at least 2 years to figure out who the personalities in the Mahabharata were. To figure out the basic Mahabharata story, which is, of course, you know, in Bhagavatam, in Krishna book. It took me 2 years to figure out what was going on. You thought it was fast?
Yeah.
Well, you know how I figured it out? In the first canto Bhagavatam, there's all these purports where Prabhupada gives biographies of the different persons, like at the passing of Bhisma, and I think also the sages who come to see Parikkhit. And that was how I finally got it. I mean, I read Krishna book a couple times. Of course, I was listening to Prabhupada's lectures, probably 3 or 4 lectures a day. So that also helped. And I was going to Bhagavatam class every day and Bhagavad Gita class every night. I'm sure that helped. But I remember when I read the biography, it was like, oh, okay. Symbols of status. We definitely have symbols of status. We have interesting symbols of status. Our, as I said before, our status symbols tend to be the reverse of the outside society. And looking at both the public and the members, what kind of picture do they get? What symbolizes the movement for them? You know, if you ask the members, okay, come up with some symbol of the movement, some picture of the movement, what would they come up with? If you ask people in general, what picture, a symbol of the Hare Krishna would you come up with? That's going to tell you also a lot about organizational culture. Okay, control systems. So where are there the strongest controls? Where are there the heaviest rules? What process, what procedure, what part of the organization has the most control? And is the organization generally loosely or tightly controlled? Do people get rewarded for good service, or do they get penalized for bad service? Does nobody care? Does nobody notice? Or do people only notice the good, or do they only notice the bad? We might also say here, are there certain kinds of service that are rewarded and punished and certain kinds that are ignored? I think there are. What kind of reports do we issue to keep track of things? Now, the reason this sort of thing is important is you see a lot about an organizational culture by what we notice and what we don't notice. What do we pay attention to? I once visited a secondary school, ordinary secondary school, and everything in the front hallway of the school was about sports. Everything. They had sports trophies, and they had sports banners, and they had nothing about academics. Nothing in the whole entranceway of the secondary school 100% was about sports. That tells you a lot about the culture of the school. There were no trophies for debate. You know, there was no list of the exam scores. There was just a list of their soccer championships. So what do we issue reports on? Okay, power. This is a very important question. Who has the real power in the organization? In most organizations, the people who have the titles of power do not necessarily have the real power. So having the title and having the power is not necessarily the same. So the people who have the real power, first of all, you've got to identify them. Who are the people who have the real power? What do they believe and promote? Who makes decisions? Who influences decisions? How is the power used or abused? Okay. Now we're going to look at organizational structure. Organizational structure is part of organizational culture, but it's also quite a big topic in and of itself. And we were originally going to do this in 2 days and spend 1 day just on organizational structure. If you're interested, I have some materials that I could send you by email on this. So we have 4 questions here. One is, what are the formal lines of authority? That's a pretty easy question to answer. We have, you know, we have the GBC. We have, of course, now it's become a lot more complicated. We have GBCs, and we have divisional directors, and we have ministers of various areas. So, you know, your temple is going to be under a particular temple president and a particular GBC for your geographical region. But if you start a farm, then your farm also is under the Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Cow Protection. If you start a school, the school is under the Minister of Education. If you have sannyasis, they're under the sannyas ministry, right? So you have like all these different formal lines of authority. We never talk about those parallel lines of authority, do we? But those are just as much parallel lines of authority, if not more so, really, than the gurus. What are the informal lines of authority? Now, again, often our informal lines of authority are often more significant than our formal lines of authority. So in ISKCON, our Diksha gurus are an informal line of authority. They're not really a formal. They don't have the Diksha gurus do not necessarily have some position of authority in terms of the organization. Of course, some do. Okay, then the last two things we're going to have to discuss more. Is the organization mostly organic or mostly mechanical? Is it mostly centralized or is it mostly decentralized? And now here we're looking again at a kind of chart with, again, the two criteria. Organic or mechanical, centralized, decentralized. So why do we care about the structure of an organization? So it's important because form follows function. So this is a quote from L.H. Sullivan, a very, very famous architect. So you can understand why an architect would come to the conclusion that form follows function. If you want to have a window, you know, that opens, it has to have a particular form. So he talks about that form ever follows function, and this is the law. Now, of course, he didn't really know about things metaphysical, because Krishna can do things. Krishna can have functions with various forms. So Krishna can eat with his eyes, and Krishna can walk with his nose. And so Krishna has a form where the function is not dependent upon the form. Although Krishna generally eats with his mouth. You don't see pictures of Krishna in the spiritual world putting food in his ears. Yes, he generally eats with his mouth. He generally walks with his leg. But, of course, for Krishna and liberated souls, there's a great fluidity of form and function. But at least on the material level, form definitely follows function. The form of something is completely related to the function. If you want to walk, you get legs. You want to fly, you get wings. You don't walk with wings. Right? Creatures who have wings, they're generally awkward walkers. Right? Form follows function. So the form of an organization has a lot to do with the culture of an organization and the function of an organization. If you have an organizational form that doesn't fit your organizational culture, one's going to pull the other. Either your culture is going to change the form or your form is going to change the culture. Okay, so let's look, and this is really brief, folks. Okay, this is just a little taste of what we mean by organizational structure. There's great big, you know, 500-page books on organizational structure. And again, what I'm presenting is not the only way of understanding organizational structure. There are other ways. I've chosen this way, again, because it's fairly easy to understand, it's fairly simple, and because I see that it connects very, very closely with Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's teachings. So the first thing that we're looking at is our structure. Our form, is it an organic form or is it a mechanical form? So there are three ways to have a mechanical form. Mechanical means everything is standard, right? That's what a machine is. A machine is things are standard. You understand? Right? Human beings are not standard. Living systems are not standard. On one plant, there's many daisies, but no daisy is exactly like the other daisy, even on the same plant. Okay? So mechanical structures have standardization. So the least mechanical is standardized training. Everybody gets the same training. That's the least mechanical system, is if everybody gets exactly the same training. Middle mechanical is if you standardize the end results. The product has to be exactly the same. So you may get different kinds of training, you may do it in different ways. You're looking at three different parts. How you get trained, what you do, what the result is. I mean, let's think of it in terms of deity worship. So does everyone have to have the same result in dressing the deities? Does everyone have to dress the deities? Does the deities have to look the same? That would be an end result. Does everyone have to dress the deities in exactly the same way? Do they have to follow the same exact procedures? And do they have to get the same training? Now, it's interesting about deity worship. I particularly bring this up because for many, 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 many years, I assumed that deity worship had to have a mechanical form. that everyone had to get the same training and everyone had to have the same processes. And then a few years ago, I was working with Gaur Keshava Prabhu on my own personal worship of my own shilas. I had at that time received a Sudarshan Shalagram, and he was telling me, okay, well, if you're going to worship the Shalagram, you have to follow certain procedures. So he first sent me a list of procedures to follow. And I wrote back to him and I said, Prabhu, I'm not going to do this. I said, it's just not me, and I know I'm not going to do it. I said, I might feel guilty about it, but I'm just not going to do it. It's not going to work for me. And I don't know what to do. And I really believed that I had to do that procedure or else I was offensive, and I was really stuck. And he said, well, there's another procedure. Really? I had no idea that there was another procedure. He said, here's another procedure. So he showed me that, and I said, well, this is better for me, but it's still, doesn't fit me. I don't like it. I'm not happy about it. I wouldn't want to do it. And he said, well, there's another procedure. And I was just shocked. He said, yeah, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Bhajana Rahasya gives a padati for Archana. He said, maybe this would be more suitable for you. So he showed it to me, and I said, oh, that's what I want. That's mine. And then he said, okay, but there's more than one way to do this. He said, okay, do you want to worship first your Krishna Govardhan, then your Radha Govardhan, then your Kurma Shalagram, then your Sudarshan Shalagram? Do you want to go through the whole procedure four times? And I said, no. He said, well, would you want to go through it three times? Once for Radhakrishna, once for Kurma, once for Sudarshan. I said, no. He said, well, you can go through it one time, and you consider Radhakrishna the main deities, and then you say your basic mantra once, and then you say three mula mantras. I'm like, oh, that's nice. And then he gave me all different choices. He said, okay, this is your mantras to meditate first. You can do this mantra that Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives, or you could do this mantra. I mean, I was fascinated. And I said, I always thought the deity worship was some kind of a really, you know, set science. He said, no, it's an art. You're dealing with a person. And it really just opened up my whole mind and hopefully my heart a little bit to the idea that deity worship wasn't mechanical. I mean, how could deity worship be mechanical when you're dealing with a person? But in any case, something mechanical is if everybody gets exactly the same training, that's the least kind of mechanical. If everyone gets exactly the same training, but then you can do things in your own way and get your own result. So that's the least. More than that is if everybody has to get exactly the same result, we don't care how you did it, we don't care what training you got. And the most standardized is everyone has to do everything exactly the same way. So some time ago, there was a temple president who wrote a letter to a number of devotees asking whether or not devotees could meditate on the written form of the Hare Krishna mantra while chanting japa. So many of us answered, and I answered, yes, you can. This is a standard procedure done by our acharyas and even recommended by some of our acharyas, that while chanting Hare Krishna, you can meditate on the written words of the mantra. And this temple president didn't like that answer. He was asking us to get an answer of, no, you're not allowed to. You know, and he said, well, it's become a fashion in our temple that everybody walks around with little cards with the mantra on it during japa, and we want to make it forbidden in the temple. And I said, well, I don't see how you can forbid it when it's done by our acharyas and recommended by our acharyas. How can you forbid something in a Hare Krishna temple that's recommended by our acharyas? But that's what he ended up doing. So that's the extreme mechanical. Everybody has to chant japa in exactly the same way. You follow? Is that pretty clear? Okay. Now, organic structure. There's two ways to have an organic structure. One way is you have a leader who directly supervises everybody. You don't have in-between people. So the leader is directly supervising everyone. They're dealing with everyone on an individual basis. And the other way to have an organic structure is you have teams or committees that are always changing. Not always changing, like every minute. But, you know, you form a committee for a particular purpose. That committee has a particular leader. When that purpose is achieved, you disband the committee And then for another purpose, you form another committee, and that committee will have a different leader. The person who's the leader in one area will not be the leader in another area. Okay, that's about organic and mechanical. Now we're going to look at centralization and decentralization. So you can remember this by ICE. And then I'm going to put an A. So it's going to be I-A-C-A-E-A. So ICE with I-A-C-A-E-A. These are the areas of power in an organization. These are the areas of power in an organization. Information. So in ISKCON in general, we have a big problem with information. We do not have accurate information about our movement. Now, this is a problem shared by almost every religious organization. It's not unique to ISKCON. We have no idea in ISKCON how many members we have. We don't even know what a member is. So we really don't have a clue as to how many members we have. We don't even know, amazingly enough, we should be able to know this, we don't even know how many initiated devotees there are. Some of the gurus keep records and some don't. So we don't have a list, we don't even have a number of how many people have taken initiation since 1965. You know, the example I give a lot is, I gave it the other day, we don't know what the divorce rate is. We don't know. When I did my study of all the teachers in the movement, all the teachers in primary and secondary schools, that was in the fall of 2005, like September, October, November 2005, I found a divorce or widowed rate of 2% and a second marriage rate of 1.7%. That was among all of the, I got responses from 90% of the teachers in ISKCON-related primary and secondary schools. So, you know, I have people telling me the divorce rate in ISKCON is 70%. It's like, well, what study did you do? What's your research? I often find also that information that we get is almost always, what, negative or positive?
Negative.
It's almost always negative. So people tell you this negative information about ISKCON, and if you ask them, where did you get your information from? Where's the data? They don't have any. There's no study. I mean, just recently, a devotee who I happen to like very much posted something in a conference that I'm a member of that said that most of the graduates of our Gurukula schools have not made any contribution to the society in general. Wow, what a statement. And I said, you know, we don't even know who's been to our schools. We don't have records of everyone who's been to our schools. And been to our schools for how long? 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 15 years? A student who's been to our schools, what does that mean? We don't even have a number. If we say how many people have been in Hare Krishna schools for at least 2 years, we don't know. It would be a wild guess. How many people have been in our Hare Krishna schools for, you know, 10 or 12 years and graduated? Again, we don't know, although that might be a little easier to figure out. That might only take us like 2 years to figure out. We really don't know. And what are all those people doing with their lives? Again, we don't know. We don't even know who they are. We don't even know how many of them there are. So if we're going to make some statement that anybody, you know, who's been to, and the person also said, most of them have not made any contribution to outside society, but most of them are working in ISKCON as Brahmins. I was like, whoa, where is this information coming from? That most of the people who went to our ISKCON schools are working in ISKCON as Brahmins. Interesting. So we don't have information. We don't have information. We do not know how many people who take initiation keep their vows. We don't know that. We just don't know. Again, we can guess, but we really don't know. We don't know at what age people are getting married. We don't know how much people are reading Srila Prabhupada's books every day. We don't know what kind of occupations our members have. We really have almost no information about our ISKCON society at all. And we don't have very many people that are even interested in collecting that information. So the information that we have is almost all guesswork. And it's almost all what we call anecdotal information. So I have 15 good friends and 10 of them are divorced, so I decide that everyone in ISKCON is getting divorced. You know, and my good friend has three teenage kids and they're all doing yagyas in ISKCON temples, so I decide that most kids who go to ISKCON schools do yagyas in ISKCON temples. It's mostly that kind of anecdotal experience. Now, the problem is that information drives everything. How are you going to make good choices about anything if you don't have good information? We would say about computers, garbage in, garbage out. Now, we talked about this quite a lot the other day with relevant and relatable ISKCON, right? That the thrust of that presentation was that if you're going to make your preaching programs relevant and relatable to people, you've got to know something about the people to whom you want to be relevant and relatable. How can I decide whether I'm relevant to you if I don't know you? It doesn't really make any sense. But somehow we don't have this priority. It's funny, it's like we have this ethos in our movement that gathering information is not important. It's like all information is just supposed to be revealed. You know, I just sit down and I chant my 16 rounds with attention, then I just know what the divorce rate is in this kind, you know. So it's sort of a strange thing. And it's not that we do without this information. It's not that it doesn't matter. What happens is we make it up. That's what happens. It's not that we don't care. We just make it up. All right, that's the first part of power. Who is providing the information? Where the information comes from is the first part of power in an organization. Do you see how who supplies the information would also have a lot of power in an organization? Does that make sense? Where you're getting your information from? Who is the source of information? Are the people who have power. Oh, another kind of information is what's bona fide. So the people that are preaching, this is the way you have to do things, this is what's bona fide, they're a big source of information in our movement. And some of those people are getting their information from Sadhu Shastra Guru, and some of them, I'm going to just say honestly, are making it up. We do have people who sit on the Vyasa Sun and make things up. Some people do it as a regular habit. And this is also a source of information for just what does it say in the Shastra? What is correct? What is not correct? All right, then advice. So I have all this information. You know, how many people are getting married? How many people give money to the movement? What does it say? You know, what is the rules about how people are supposed to behave from the tradition? And then I take advice as to how do I use this information to progress. So the people who are giving advice also have a lot of power in an organization. Then choice. Who makes the choice? Okay, I've got all this information. I have all this advice. This is what we're going to do. Now, you might say choice and authorization is the same, but it's not necessarily the same. Because I can make a choice, but if nobody authorizes it, it doesn't happen. Sometimes the person who makes a choice and the person who authorizes it is different. Just like with the GBC, I'm on the Shastric Advisory Council. So the GBC will sometimes ask the Shastric Advisory Council for advice, and sometimes they ask the Shastric Advisory Council to make a choice. Like they asked us years ago, should the big Panchatattva deities in Mayapur, should Dvaitacharya have a beard or not? So they weren't just asking us for advice, they were asking us to make a choice. Because we gave advice, we said, well, this place it says this, this place it said this, we gave information, then we also said, this is what we choose. But we are not the authorization body. The Shastric Advisory Council cannot authorize anything. So who actually authorizes the choice? Who said, okay, this is the choice? Then execution, that's the plan of execution. How are you going to do it? With the Dvaitacharya's beard, the decision for execution was that the deity would be cast without a beard and there would be a wig-like beard put on, whereas the deities here are cast with a beard. So a Dvaitacharya's beard in Mayapur could be removed. Now, so that was the plan of execution. Then who actually does it? Who actually, you know, makes the mold for the deities? Who actually makes the wig? Who does the action? In organizational theory, we call these the street-level bureaucrats. Now, that's also a level of power because if you're the one doing the action and you decide that you're not going to follow the authority, you have a lot of power, don't you? The people doing the action don't have to follow the authority. So an organization is centralized when one person or one group of people control all of this stuff. That's a very centralized organization. Just like in communist countries, they control the information, don't they? Right? Communist dictatorships, you have one person or one group of people that tries to control all of this. And the most decentralized is when the leader only controls choice, when the only thing the leader does is make the choice. Is that clear? Okay, then there's formal and informal power. Choice and authorization is formal, everything else is informal. Information is informal, advice is informal. The plan of execution is informal, the people actually doing the action is informal. But you still have power. If you make the plan, you have power, don't you? But that's not usually formal power. Now we say, in general, power rests with the people who are gathering the information, because everything rests upon information. Everything rests upon information. So whoever is giving the information generally are the ones who have the most power in the organization. Yes?
One question.
Yes?
If someone gives some advices and they're not correct, should they take any responsibility for this?
Who take responsibility?
Who's giving you advice?
Well, of course. We have to take responsibility at all levels of power. First of all, we should understand that these are all power. All of these things are the people who have power in the organization. And if we are doing any of these things, then we should recognize that we have power in the organization, and therefore we have responsibility, a lot of responsibility. Okay, why I picked this model of organizational structure is because there are statements from Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and Srila Prabhupada that relate to this particular model. This is about the story of Putana, where Bhaktisiddhanta says, "The original purpose of the established churches of the world may not always be objectionable, but no stable religious arrangement for instructing the masses has yet been successful." So he's talking about stability and flexibility, isn't he? Bhaktisiddhanta is saying, if you try to have a stable religious arrangement, you'll lose the ability to instruct the masses in spirituality. The Supreme Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya, in pursuance of the teachings of the scriptures, enjoins all absence of conventionalism for the teachers of the eternal religion. It does not follow that the mechanical adoption of the unconventional life by any person will make him a fit teacher of religion. So he's saying, don't go with mechanical, go with organic. Regulation is necessary for controlling the inherent worldliness of conditioned souls, but no mechanical regulation has any value even for such a purpose. That I find to be an absolutely amazing statement. It is no value. He says, no mechanical arrangement, even for controlling our senses, for controlling our worldliness, will have any value. The bona fide teacher of the religion is neither any product nor the favor of any mechanical system. In his hands, no system has likewise the chance of denigrating into a lifeless arrangement. So again, the opposite of mechanical is organic, is living. You have a living spiritual organization. So I would say, on the basis of these statements of Bhaktisiddhanta, see, what I see is a lot of devotees know about this quote of Bhaktisiddhanta, but what I find is devotees mostly ignore it. Because they say, well, ISKCON is an organization. Shouldn't an organization be stable? How can you have an unstable organization? But you can. You can have a flexible organization.
Is it possible to have parts of organization that are stable and then other parts that are flexible?
Well, as I said, yes, you can. But on the whole, the organization should be flexible, not stable. According to Bhaktisiddhanta. And on the whole, the organization should be organic and not mechanical. So again, I see most people have in their heads, without realizing it, this idea that organization equals stable and mechanical. That's what it means to have an organization. But there's more than one way to have an organization. Yes?
I would just like to ask, the things like having organized membership in a society, do they bring stability or flexibility?
Depends how you do it. depends how you do it. Like the family structure, a family may be stable in the sense that the family stays together, but the family's culture, it's not a stable culture. It's a flexible culture. It's not rigid. It's not mechanical. Stable in the sense of being rigid and mechanical. Something alive cannot function that way. You'll die. If you're alive, you have some stability in that you have a sense of identity, but you also have to have a tremendous amount of flexibility. You can't dress the same way every day unless you live in Hawaii. You know, even there, it rains. You know, you have to have some flexibility to deal with different situations in different ways. Otherwise, you're not alive. The table can't have that kind of flexibility. This table has just stability. It's not alive. So there has to be some stability. It's not that you're totally flexible with no stability, and it's not even that you can be totally stable without any flexibility. Every organization is going to have some of everything, but what's predominant? And here's, of course, Srila Prabhupada. You want to make big plan for centralization? I do not at all approve. Do not centralize anything. And if I did not interfere, the whole thing would have been killed. So someday I'm going to collect the quotes from Prabhupada about what he said would destroy ISKCON. Because there's a number of different things that Prabhupada said. If you do this, everything will be killed. These are all nonsense proposals. Only thing I wanted was that books printing and distribution should be centralized. Forget this centralization and bureaucracy. So Prabhupada's talking here about, again, the two things we look at in an organizational structure. We look at it centralized, decentralized, and we look at bureaucratic and organic. Bureaucratic is another word for mechanical. So we look at, is it bureaucratic or organic? Is it centralized or decentralized? Okay, so now we're going to look back at our organizational structure. Now hopefully we understand what we're talking about. Is our organizational structure organic or mechanical? Another word for mechanical is bureaucratic. Is it centralized or decentralized? What are the formal and informal lines of authority? Okay, so right now we're going to do a little exercise here, and we need people in six groups. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So it's going to be two people in each group and three people in one group. So here we have... I see, these are not organized
sets.
Like that.
They're sets.
Okay, so we'll just give everyone a set and then... Here. You can ask whatever you like, but let me take care of this. So, who would like to look at stories? We can take about 10, 15 minutes. Who would like to look at stories? What group would like to look at stories? Why don't you first get into groups, okay? Groups of two, and one group's going to have three. So you need to pick one of them, or maybe we'll just have to have two groups of three. Okay, who wants to pick stories? Okay, just a sign. Okay, stories. What do you guys want to do? Pick something.
Symbols.
Okay, you guys have symbols. What do you two want to
do? Procedures.
You'll do which one?
Second.
Which is what?
Routines.
Routines, okay.
Procedures.
And what are you two going to do?
We have no idea.
Well, again, have an idea, please. Get an idea. Pick one thing.
Symbols.
Didn't we already have some symbols?
No, we have symbols.
What did you guys say?
Symbols.
They have symbols already. So what do you want?
What's left?
Well, we got stories, symbols, and rules and procedures. What do you want?
We have stories.
They have stories. They have symbols. They have the procedures. What do you want?
I don't know the symbols.
Regulatory structures? Are you taking regulatory structures?
Procedures and routines.
Procedures and routines. Okay, your regulatory structures. What you do want to have? You want some prasad. You have to serve prasad. Okay, then you have to do it yourself. What do you want to take? We have to decide. What do you want? What? Authority. Is that what you have? No. Okay, so what's left for you? I think structure is probably left for you. So you have to take structure. Okay, so please work in a group and answer those questions.